Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with jazz multi-instrumentalist, educator, and a legend in the field, Mr. Steve Wilson. Whether he is on the sax, flute, clarinet, or piccolo, he's going to nail it, and with the biggest names in jazz. From his home of Hampton, Virginia, to gigs all over the world, Steve is an extremely busy man on stage, in the studio, and in the classroom. Over the course of our conversation, he was candid about his life in jazz, who has taught him the most, what might be next, along with a trove of great anecdotes and stories. Dig it, my friends.
Hey, Steve, thank you for taking some time to talk with me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Let me go ahead and start off here and ask you, what has been going on with you lately?
A lot. it's been a very busy period. But that's a great thing. With this new record release or CD release of my quartet, which we recorded live at Village Vanguard last year, and we just finished a Midwest tour a couple of weeks ago, and we've had a couple of other dates. We were playing in Virginia last week, and we're playing College Jazz Festival in Durham, North Carolina this weekend. Then we have a four-night engagement in New York for the actual CD release gig at the Jazz Standard in New York City. That's the second week of May. And then we're doing some dates later this year, including the Saratoga Jazz Festival in June, some other dates later in the summer and the fall. So that's been sort of the primary focus at this point of with my quartet, with Sonia's Grain. And there's been other activity, too. I actually did another CD release with the duo I have with Lewis Nash. And that came out last August, and we had some touring activity around that last fall, and planning some other dates for later this year as well. And been touring a lot with Billy Childs' quartet, and we have some more dates coming up this year with that band. And Maria Schneider's new recording is coming out very soon. I've been a part of that orchestra for... I think steadily enough, almost 10 years or so. So that'll be coming out soon. We've got some activity around that, some touring in the fall and some dates in the spring and our yearly gig at the Jazz Standard in November. And also some work with Frank Kimbrough, pianist Frank Kimbrough's quartet. So that covers a lot of the performing activity, and I mean there's other stuff too, but and then also I'm a full-time professor at City College of New York and part-time at Juilliard, so it's collectively it's like many pieces of a big, great big puzzle. That's getting
yes.
Very busy.
Absolutely. So coming from Kansas City, I got a hyper-local question for you. What is it like touring in the Midwest? Do you like touring the Midwest? What's the reception like?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I'm in Whitewater, Wisconsin now. I'm doing a residency at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. And I just finished another one at the University of Kansas about a week ago, a couple weeks ago. And with our tour that we just did in Midwest, I mean, the Midwest is great. We love it. You know, it's great to get in the heartland of America and just meet a lot of nice, soulful people. Who are, you know, unpretentious and just they're very down home, and just to see this part of the world and get a feel for it, another side of Americana. And I remember some years ago when we toured with the Blue Note 7, and we did a 50-city tour by bus. All wow. In the United States, which is a rare thing these days for a jazz group.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful to tour and places like Sioux Falls and Norman, Oklahoma and Boulder, Colorado. And, man, we found that they were the best audiences.
Right on.
I love it. I love, you know, getting in touch with people and, you know, just seeing where they're coming from and getting a feel for the local culture and flavor, and it's a beautiful thing.
Right on. So you were born and raised in Hampton, Virginia. What was it like as far as getting you geared for a career in jazz there? What was it like growing up there?
Well, I was lucky at that time because growing up in the 60s and 70s, a few things happened. One, my father was a music fan. He was not a trained musician, but he sang in a choir, in an all-male gospel and spiritual choir. And I got to hear them perform quite often. So I got a lot of that music, of course, with, you know, the church background. But also the other thing was, well, a couple other things. He had a very eclectic record collection. So he, you know, through him, I first heard Miles Davis, Ahmad Jamal, but along with, you know, some other things like, you know, Johnny Mathis, James Brown, Stax, the Beatles. He kind of had everything.
Yeah.
He dug everything. And the other significant thing was he took me to the Hampton Jazz Festival starting in 1968. And that was one of George Wein's festivals, because George has some family ties in Hampton. And they put on the annual festival at what was then Hampton Institute, now Hampton University. And they would do usually a 2 or 3 night weekend every June, every summer. So I got introduced to the music, you know, seeing, you know, some of the great artists live, you know, from the time I was like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. People like Ross Arnold and Kirk, Eddie Harris, Stanley Turrentine, Sly and the Family Stone, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Freddie Hubbard, Cannonball Adderley. So I got introduced to them, you know, by way of live performances. And that certainly had a huge impact, changed the course of my life, really. So it was all of that, really, that... you know, at that time, growing up in Hampton, and along there were some other local musicians who were great players, and then all of the kids in my neighborhood at that time played an instrument. Everyone played music and sports, so all of those things collectively really helped to shape me for, you know, where I went from there.
So as a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Pretty much always a musician. Of course, you know, being a younger kid, you fantasize about a lot of things, but, you know, being an athlete or a fireman or whatever. But I knew by my early teens I pretty much wanted to play music as a profession. The only other thing I ever had desired to do was maybe be a social worker. But I think through music I've been able to sort of address both being an artist and a social worker. So, but pretty much knew early on this is what I wanted to do.
So during your teens, you played the oboe and the drums and R&B and funk bands. Why
mm-hmm.
didn't that stick? What was it about jazz that was like, that's where I want to be?
Well, those things all served a great purpose and all served in my total musicianship and appreciation of music, which serves my being a jazz musician. Because jazz music is inclusive by nature. I mean, it's a fusion music. It's made up of many different elements. So those experiences made me a better musician. And I still carry a lot of those disciplines to a lot of the things that I'm doing now, you know. Oboe particularly, which I played for 2 years in high school and my first year in college, playing a lot of symphonic wind band. And those experiences served me in playing in big band and particularly Maria Schneider's group, because the way she writes is more orchestral in nature than a traditional big band. So a lot of those same disciplines, you know, with the orchestral concept, serves me well to, you know, a lot of other things I'm doing in jazz.
So speaking of Virginia Commonwealth University, during that time you either performed or studied with the great Jimmy and Percy Heath,
mm-hmm.
John Hendricks, Frank Foster, Elias Marsalis. What was that like during that formative time of your life, really developing a music brain? What did they do for you?
Man, I it's so valuable to be, you know, in a school that brought these people in as artists in residence so that we could have the day-to-day contact. And then, you know, to get the oral tradition straight from the source, which is essential in this music if you're going to be a practitioner. The academic part of it, of course, is valuable, but, you know, this music is has evolved because of, you know, apprenticeships served, you know, the information passed down from one generation to the next. And that's the stuff that happens on the gig, on the bandstand, you know, spending personal time with them, and you learn the etiquette of being a performer, the nuances of the music. So having those guys to come through and getting this firsthand knowledge, I mean, there's just no substitute for that.
Yeah.
And also, you know, those were contacts that I had when I moved to New York. So it served all of those purposes.
So you moved to New York in 87, and you tour with Lionel Hampton. Then you become a first choice for vets and emerging artists. What was that like to jump into the hotbed of New York jazz and get so immersed in the scene so quickly?
Well, it was a great experience. I mean, I was starting from scratch, really. I did, you know, I knew a lot of people when I moved there, but it took me a while to get some traction in terms of being a working musician. But that's, you know, that's not unusual. And I'm glad for that experience because it made me appreciate every experience that I had. A lot of gigs that I did that were off the radar, you know, there's, again, no substitute for that kind of training to be on a gig and, you know, playing with different people who are great musicians, folks that I had not heard of before I moved to New York. But the other part of it was being able to work with the musicians that I had idolized or, you know, seen on hundreds of recordings, you know, and I'm speaking of the Victor Lewis's, the Kenny Barons, being able to see these people every night and learn from watching them or playing with them. So I'm learning from the elders, likewise playing with Lionel Hampton, Ellis Marsalis, Buster Williams. So I'm getting to learn from the elders and getting that apprenticeship. And then also, on the other side, playing with my peers, doing some more experimental type of work. So I was getting the best of both sides, I think. So I'm very appreciative for that experience.
So you kind of touched on that bus tour that you did, the 50-state tour. What was that like to be with the Blue Note 7? That had to be, at that point in your life, that had to be a really exhilarating kind of thing to be involved with.
Oh, yeah. It was fantastic because, one, we are all friends. So though it was put together as an all-star band, there was not an all-star feel to it off the bandstand. I mean, everybody respected each other, you know, and we got along great, and, you know, we were all there to serve the higher purpose of the music, and it really was a band. It wasn't just some all-star lineup, you know, to tour. Of course, it was billed that way, but it really was a band. You know, we wrote arrangements for that particular group, and the more we played, you know, as any, you know, when you get a band of great players together, a group of great players together, and they can play every night, it really turns into something special. And it was like, wow, why can't this be done all the time?
Yeah.
You know, and we actually had attempted to extend the life of the band because by the middle of the tour, we had written even more music for the band to record another CD, but the Blue Note label was not interested in it, unfortunately. And I think they blew a golden opportunity. But so subsequently, we recorded we did a week at the at Birdland in New York when we finished the tour, and we financed our own recording, and we have a partnership. We collectively own the masters of that.
Right.
So maybe someday we'll see the light of day, you know. But yeah, it was a great project, man, and we really loved doing it. And who knows, maybe it could happen again.
Yeah, right on. We'd love to hear it. So over the years, as you've gotten to a point that you're a huge name in jazz these days, all of these guys that you played with over the years, George Duke, Dave Holland, you know, Billy Childs, all these guys, What was it like to get on stage as you were developing your presence on the stage? What was it like to be around greatness like that?
Oh, man, it's humbling, very humbling, and still is, you know, because these are giants in the industry, and they are just some of the most profound artists that we've had in the music. I mean, these guys are like geniuses, you know, and they are down-to-earth people, so they're very nurturing. They want you to bring what you have to the music, and they encourage that, and they're very trusting in that. So to be given the opportunity to work with these amazing artists and great people is just a very humbling situation. And I'm, you know, every time it happens, I'm very thankful for it. I try to make the most of it and have fun and get to pick their brains about, you know, music and life. And it's just a humbling experience to be around such amazing people.
Right on. So is there anybody that's out there in the world of jazz that you haven't played with that you're like, man, I'd love to gig with them at some point?
Oh, yeah. I've never played with Roy Haynes. He's one of my favorite drummers of all time. And, you know, I know he just turned 90. And thank goodness he's still very active. So Roy Haynes has been on my wish list. Herbie Hancock, another one's been on my wish list. Let's see. I know there are more, there are many more. But those are two at the top of the list.
So you spoke about all of these masters that you've been around that have taught you so much. As a teacher, what do you try to teach those that you're giving it to?
Well, I try to bring that oral tradition to it, and I try to, you know, cast down the nuances that cannot be taught in the classroom, the nuances of the music, of the business, those things that have been passed on to me from, you know, the elders I work with. And a lot of it involves, you know, off the bandstand stuff, you know, how to conduct oneself, thinking about your life and the music in a bigger perspective, you know, and that, you know, the music is what you bring to it. It's this music reflects your humanity. It's not just about learning the technique and the chord changes, and all of that's great, but what's behind the notes? You know, what's the story that you want to tell? Does the student understand the cultural significance that this music has had, you know, not just the United States, but across the world, and the cultural impact? So I try to bring that perspective, a bigger picture perspective, because that's the stuff, you know, that, quite frankly, you can't really teach in school, and it can't really be taught as part of a curriculum. It has to be lived. So that's the awareness that I try to bring to my teaching.
Who taught you the most about jazz?
Oh, man, I don't think there was any one person. but I will credit one of my great mentors, Doug Richards, who was the director of the Jazz Studies Program at Virginia Commonwealth University up until about 10 years ago. And when I, you know, attended school there in the early 80s, he was really the one that introduced me to the history of the music and its significance. So we were dealing with, like, you know, Jelly Roll Morton and Louis Armstrong and Gil Evans and Fletcher Henderson. So he's the one that really pulled my coat to the roots and the history, not just by way of a classroom setting, but by way of playing that music and getting deep inside of it. So if there's anyone that I would credit for that, it's him.
So all the awards that you've won over the years, is there one that really sticks out as something very special to you?
Wow. I can't say that there's one particularly. I mean, because you know, recognition for one's work is always a really nice thing. And honestly, I don't try to give it too much value, and I'm very appreciative of the awards and accolades, but it's nice to be recognized, but I'm also always mindful that, you know, how much farther I have to go and to grow, and so it's really the music and the great practitioners, you know, past, present, and future that keep me motivated. But I can't say that there's really one award out of any of them. Maybe the Mark Crawford Educators Award that I got from NYU some years ago, and it recognized my commitment to teaching and educating. But collectively, I mean, they all mean a lot, you know. But I don't lose perspective on that, you know.
Sure, sure. Yeah, yeah, right on. So there's a myriad of people in the world that look up to you as a jazz hero. Who do you consider your jazz heroes?
Oh, man, there's so many. Well, I, you know, of course, these days, you know, we've seen a lot of them pass away in recent years. The Joe Wilders, the Clark Terrys, of course, John Hicks's. The list is so long, man. I guess at the top of my saxophone list would be Johnny Hodges.
Yeah.
I mean, among many, many others. But for me, they're all heroes because they were the architects of the music.
Yeah.
And they're the shoulders we stand on. So, you know, it's I could probably name you a shorter list of people I don't like. but we could be here for 2 days naming all of those
yeah.
lists of heroes, yeah.
Yeah, right on. What's the greatest thing about waking up every day?
Just knowing that there's another opportunity to grow, to learn something. And not just in music, but just to, you know, just about living and from, you know, having contact with people and meeting new people and having new experiences. And 'cause there's so much to get to. And, you know, we're here basically for a very short lifetime. So so every day is an opportunity for growth, and that's what, to me, that's what it's all about.
Right on. What is the proverbial next for you? Not just in the next year, but in your career, what do you want to accomplish?
Well, in the big picture, just to continue to work with the best people I can work with, and to work in new musical vistas. There's a lot of situations that I would love to do. I'd love to, you know, work with orchestras more, and some more large ensemble work, you know, with chamber orchestras, with the brass ensemble, with voices, you know, with choirs. And then, you know, make some other types of music too. You know, because I'm wide open. I'm wide open for new experiences. So, and there's a lot of things going on right now. There's some, you know, great young musicians, young artists and composers out there that are doing some marvelous things. Some of them are my former students, and they are just on the cusp of doing some amazing work and opening some new ground. So I'm excited to see it and hopefully be a part of it.
Right on. So if there were some people at a party talking about jazz and they brought up big names, your name comes up, and someone's like, man, I'm going to go home and Google him. What would you want, like, a 2-3 sentence piece of your bio to say, and what album would you want them to listen to?
Oh, wow, that's a hard one. Because I honestly have a hard time listening to my own recordings because I hear stuff, you know, I listen to myself and go, oh, I should have done that, I should have done this. Well, I don't know. I guess if there's one of my recordings at this point, it would be Soulful Song. And just because conceptually it captures just a very important time for me, and that recording is meant as a tribute to Black radio, which, of course, in the 60s and 70s is very important.
Yeah.
and it really helped to shape my value system, which, you know, affects everything else that I do personally and artistically. So I guess if anything, it would be that recording, because it encompasses the whole spectrum of music and cultural significance that I was trying to address, you know, which of course is hard to do in one record, but
yeah.
But that's what it represents, and that's pretty much what my core is about.
Right on. Steve, thank you very much for your time today. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Steve Wilson for his many years of jazz cool and music. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.